coming up.
I'm a cop, and you will respect my authority.
What makes some forms of authority legitimate and others not?
Illegitimate authority is gained by theft, deception, or coercion.
So all state authority is illegitimate. You should resist it.
Who are you to tell me what to resist?
You are officially in charge of South Park's Fish and Wildlife. You have authority over all of them.
I have authority?
That's right. And people must respect it.
Well, that should be fine. Just fine.
Fine, just fine.
Fine. Oh, no. Nothing's worse than Carmen with authority, huh?
We all have to be political subjects.
Our guest is San Francisco State political scientist James Martell.
We have all the power already. It's just that we keep giving it away. So all we have to do is not do that anymore.
Authority and resistance.
Maybe this will teach you to listen to authority.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help again, now more than ever.
So here's what to do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Does the collapse of top-down authority mean the rise of anarchy and chaos?
Or can there be authority without hierarchy?
Who needs authority anyway?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford University campus, where Ken teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about authority and resistance.
You know, these are exciting times, Ken. I mean, all those top-down authority structures that once had everything in their vice-like grip, they're starting to collapse. You know, it's happening in politics, in the media, in medicine, even, you know, in education.
And that's a good thing?
Well, less hierarchy, more choice, more freedom. What's not to like?
I don't know. Let's see. How about the explosion in untrustworthy news sources? And the implosion of the old trustworthy ones. Or the sprouting of self-declared, self-financed demagogues of every stripe and the withering away of candidates vetted and tested by thriving political parties. And just that's just for starters, if what not to lie.
Yeah, you sound so nostalgic, Ken.
I plead guilty. Because whatever else you can say about those old top-down authority structures that you think of such with such terrible things, you know, they actually serve the people.
They serve themselves and the elitist cronies. That's why people resisted them. And that's why they're crashing down even as we speak.
Oh, yeah, right. Leaving us with chaos in the wake of their collapse.
Not chaos, Ken. Democracy. More voices having a say.
Too many voices. And no good way to decide which ones to heed and which ones to ignore. Josh, that's not democracy. That's cacophony.
Okay, democracy can get a little noisy, but that noise is the sound of good things emerging. When all ideas get a hearing, that's when truth happens. When each of us is free to voice our dreams and fears, that's when justice happens.
Oh, that's just such a pretty picture. But some noise is just noise and not music at all, not the music of democracy at all. Especially when it's produced by people, you know, who flood the social world with discredited ideas, distorting propaganda, dangerous drugs, all kinds of stuff. And you know, Josh, again, that's precisely what the old authorities promised to protect us from, isn't it?
They promised. Yeah, that's a good theory. But what about in practice? Who was actually silenced in practice? Not the snake oil salesman. It was the marginalized masses. They were told to shut up and do as they were told.
Oh, Josh, come on. By whom?
By the military-industrial complex, the bureaucratic education complex, the corporate medical pharmacological insurance complex.
Look. I'm not naive. I'm not going to deny that your gaggle of hegemonic complexes, you name. I'm not going to deny that sometimes they had, their hidden agendas.
You bet they did, Ken. That's precisely why people were right to resist them.
But even so, I'm still not convinced that our current chaos represents an improvement. Because, Josh, it's just not true that all voices deserve an equal hearing, as you seem to think. That's not true.
No, I didn't say all voices deserve an equal hearing. My point is, nobody's automatically entitled to authority over somebody else. Authority's got to be earned if it's going to be legitimate. And those ossified authority structures you're so nostalgic for, Ken, they didn't earn their authority. They usurped it.
Jeepers, I wouldn't go that far. But look. Even if what you say is true, how do you think one can earn authority rather than usurping it, especially when we face such a plethora of competing voices? Isn't that the million-dollar question for you, Mr. Oso Disruption?
Yeah, all right, fair enough. That is the million-dollar question. And to help us think more about it, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to tell us about a classic case of old authority, the school, getting disrupted, and the students, rather than the teachers, calling the shots. She files this report.
Like a lot of kids, Bart Simpson hates school.
Tonight's homework assignment is...
Oh man, is it hot in here? I better take off my sweater.
Down with... homework? Don't look at it, children.
The shirt makes a good point.
I'm with the shirt. Homework rots.
But we all know the kids who love school, like Bart's sister Lisa.
Grade me. Look at me. Evaluate and rank me. Oh, I'm good, and oh, so smart.
Teachers use grades to enforce authority, and that system worked on Lisa Simpson. It also worked on me. I remember staying up late at night trying to memorize the first 100 numbers of pi for an extra credit assignment.
3.14159, this is pi, followed by 2653589, circumference over diameter.
My math teacher ended up giving me extra credit for baking a pie instead. Social critic Noam Chomsky says pointless assignments like that one are just another form of control.
If you can guarantee lots of stupidity in the educational system, like stupid assignments and things like that, that the only people who make it through are people like me and like most of you, I guess, who are willing to do it no matter how stupid it is.
When I was a senior in high school, I dated an anarchist. He went to a school called the Manhattan Free School, where there were no grades. He told me to follow him there, or else I would turn into a mindless robot. I told him my parents wouldn't let me. He told me parents were a form of social control. So that was that, and off I went. Pat Werner trusted me to make this choice. She founded Manhattan Free School because she believes that young people should have authority over their own education.
I'd watched three children grow up from infancy, and that gave me the confidence to trust that all children come with gifts and capacities, and basically we need to get out of their way.
At Manhattan Free School, there were no grade levels, and 5-year-olds and 18-year-olds shared the same space.
There were always like interesting collection of human beings trying to make a really weird system work.
Lila Holmes also attended the school. Kids and a few adults vote on what rules to pass during democratic meetings. Of course, there was one big rule called the stop rule.
That was like the one non-negotiable one. If someone says stop, then you have to.
Meetings often turned into philosophical debates about the pros and cons of profanity and playing video games all day. If you had a complaint about someone, you'd write it down on a piece of paper and send it to the complaint committee, which was also made up of kids.
Decisions had to be made about our day-to-day lives that like we cared about and that like directly affected you in like a very real way. And there wasn't like an authority above you to make that decision for you.
But while I was at the Manhattan Free School, Lisa Simpson was still in me. All I wanted to do was read, write, and study for AP exams. And I finally had the time to do that. But anytime I complained about the chaos at the school, my anarchist boyfriend would shout at me, telling me I needed to participate more in the school's democracy if I wanted to be truly liberated.
I definitely have a lot of memories, some more traumatic than others.
Thomas Parker was one of the few adults at Manhattan Free School. He says anyone pushing the school in a particular direction was viewed as a threat to the group's commitment to democracy.
There's a lot of clarity around what we were leaving and what we were saying no to in the world, but not a whole lot of clarity on what we were going to create in its place.
What happened to the free school after I left depends on who you ask. Some former students say there was a hostile corporate takeover. Thomas says it was rebooted into school with more identity. Now it's called the Agile Learning Center. He says authority doesn't have to be a bad thing.
Children naturally look to adults for signal, for clarity, for understanding. We have authority or we have power that we can either use over people or that we can use with people.
What I learned from my time at Manhattan Free School is that resistance can look like a lot of different things. The next time an anarchist tells me to quit my job or quit my life and run away, I'm going to be defiant. I'm going to say, no, I'm just fine right here. There's power in going to school, and there's power in staying home. And there's power in deciding to resist the resistance, too. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that amazing and self-revealing report, Holly. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy, who's not an anarchist, I don't think. And we're coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco.
Our guest today is a professor of political science at San Francisco State University. He's the author of Subverting the Leviathan, Reading Thomas Hobbes as a Radical Democrat, and more recently, The Misinterpolated Subject. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, James Martell.
So, James, how did you first get interested in these questions of authority and resistance to authority? Did you spend your youth, like Holly, on the front lines of some like resistance movement or something?
Yeah, that story did sound a little familiar, but one of my earliest memories is a Che Guevara poster on my parents' refrigerator, so I think I just have it in my blood.
So you're a dead red diaper baby.
Yeah, maybe since I'm an anarchist, a black diaper baby. Same idea.
So, you're a self-proclaimed anarchist, and so I have a question about that. Does that mean that you reject all authority in every domain, or is it more about political authority? It's the thing you were contesting.
So I think authority is a good thing, actually, and I think one of the unfortunate stereotypes about anarchists is that it's just chaotic and you're stabbing people and, you know, bonfires in the street. I think authority is really important, but I think there's two different kinds of authority. There's what I would call vertical authority, which I like to call archism, which is top-down hierarchical authority, which we're all very used to. And then there's horizontal authority, which I like to call anarchism, which is collective, kind of like the Manhattan Free School. but it happens all the time in all sorts of ways that we don't recognize because we give all the credit to the vertical forms of authority.
Wait, we give all the credit to the vertical authorities. I mean, hierarchical authority, that sounds good in theory. That's kind of like we're all equals and right. But vertical authority is some people have authority over others.
Right.
And in virtue of their having authority over others, what I say goes. And that, I mean, some people argue the fact that I'm an authority, the fact that the expert is an epistemic authority, gives me reason to believe what he says. Just his saying it or her saying it gives me reason to believe. Okay, but in what sense is horizontal authority authority? If I don't have authority over you, and if I can't make it so just by my saying it so, in what sense is that horizontal? That sounds a little oxymoronic to me. That's what I'm wondering.
I think vertical forms of authority are kind of stealing from existing forms of authority that they don't recognize. So the reason that you listen to somebody, that you obey what they say, is because they come out, they're like the tip of an iceberg. They come out of this vast kind of network of horizontal decisions and negotiations and thoughts, and then they kind of come in at the last minute and they say, as if they had just made it up, you know, right then and there. So
is that true in every case? I mean, I certainly see some cases. I mean, I think science would be a good example. Science is not just one great mind. It's a huge network of people all working together in this common project. But, you know, what about charismatic leaders? You know, people like Martin Luther King or Gandhi, figures without whom it's really hard to imagine those movements being as successful as they were. I mean, surely they aren't getting all of their authority from the horizontal.
I think they are, actually. And in fact, I think charisma, you know, which Weber talked about, which is this kind of special gift that the leader has, is actually just the name for all of the authority that he stole or she stole from everybody else.
So if that's that's the case, why aren't all leaders equally charismatic?
Some are better thieves than others, I guess.
So wait a minute. So it sounds like you think there could not possibly be legitimate vertical authority, right? That all would-be vertical authority is somehow stolen or usurped. Is that right?
I think that's right, because I think that why would you need to listen to somebody if you'd already made all the decisions together? Like, what's that other person, what do they bring except for loudness and violence and scariness?
So look, we're going to have to dig into this more deeply. This is Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. Our guest is San Francisco State political scientist James Martell.
How do we distinguish between legitimate and illegitimate authority? Can authority ever be earned, or can it only ever be stolen? And does political authority have a different dynamic from, for example, scientific authority?
How to earn legitimate authority, along with questions from our highly authoritative live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our phenomenal musical guests, the Tiffany Austin Quartet. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is James Martell from San Francisco State University. And we're thinking about authority and resistance.
In a world full of competing claims to authority, how do we decide which ones to embrace and which to ignore? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone on either side of the stage.
So, James, okay, I want to go back to Josh's idea about earned authority. You know, there can't possibly be kind of like a one-size-fits-all recipe for earning authority in different domains. Authority in politics works one way. Authority in science. Hey, let's take a vote on whether the evolution is true. Theory of evolution. That doesn't seem right. So am I right or wrong? You got to earn it in different ways in different domains.
No, I think there's something to that. Like, I would not want to have a pizza delivery person do brain surgery on me, but I also wouldn't want to have a Nobel laureate in physics do brain surgery on me. I think each person gets experience in different ways through different things in their life. And in that sense, they earn something. But I think politics is maybe unique in that it is something that we can all be experts in, and we actually all should be experts in. And there's no virtue in having more experience over somebody else.
So this is something I don't quite understand. Because you think about a scientist. You know, she's going to know things. That's one thing. But she also knows how to know things. And she might well have a track record. She's made predictions. Predictions that come true, you know, the rubber meets the road. You try something out, it works. And then you're going to say, well, you know what? That's the person I'm going to go to. She's going to be the surgeon for me, right? Why shouldn't we say the same thing in politics? You know, here's a person who not only knows some things, they've been out there for a while, they've got experience, but they also know how to know. They know how to find out new things. They've got a good track record. They've made things, you know, Barack Obama, he was a great community organizer. I'm going to go behind him. Why shouldn't it be?
And you know, you're a professor of political science, and Josh knows this. Plato said that a long time ago, right? He thought democracy was the worst form of government, the second worst form of government, only better off than tyranny. Mm. And the best form of government is, well, when the philosophers rule, but people, basically, people who have a love of wisdom, people who want to know things and know how to know things. We don't give equal hearing to the person in medicine. There's a techne, as he called it, in medicine, and so in governing the city. What's wrong with that Platonic idea?
Well, I just think it's sort of unfair. Actually, in his period of time, it was a little bit different than the way we do things today. But it's sort of unfair not to let anyone get any political experience except a small handful of people, and then use that fact to prove that people aren't good at politics. You know, It just seems like we have to.
So you think it's a recipe for sort of complacency on the part of the rest of us?
Exactly. I mean, it doesn't prove that we do not have any political experience because we've been excluded from politics our entire lives. So how can you expect us to be good at it? And furthermore, it doesn't necessarily mean that the people that do have a lot of experience in politics are doing a particularly good job. I mean, look at the way things are.
Well, there is that. Okay, but there's on the other side. So on the one hand, there's the Plato's kind of defense of aristocracy, right? The best should rule. And then there's anarchy, which you're a proponent of. But there's John Stuart Mill. I wonder what you think about that. Because sometimes John Stuart Mill, I hear echoes of John Stuart Mill in what you said. John Stuart Mill says, when it comes to a person's own life, he or she is an expert when it comes to their own good, not because it's best necessarily, but because it's their life. So my life belongs to me, and I should have a kind of dominion over it. Right? And that seems right. That's kind of like at the foundation of liberal democracy. But you seem to want to go further than that, right? I mean, because the Millian argument doesn't lead to anarchy, right? It doesn't lead to only this horizontal. So what gets you? I mean, it sounds like you and Mill start at a similar point. My life. Mm-hmm. I'm not subject to the whims of this person or that person or even the whims of custom. It's my life. What I decide is best because it's mine.
Right.
Why does that not lead to anarchy?
Well, where I disagree with Mill is I don't think of everyone as a single isolated monad who is just an expert on their own small life. I think, like, as a collectivity, we also know our own good, and we also know what's best for us, so we should be allowed to express that in actual political ways. So that's really where I differ from him, where I personally am not really a liberal.
So do you, I'm a Brit, and, I'm suffering from a double trauma of living here currently and my country busy destroying itself. Mm-hmm. So are you going to sit there and tell me that we really know what's best for us? They were brilliant. They had a referendum in Britain. They called upon the wisdom of the population as a whole. And they exercised what you're talking about, right? Their great wisdom about politics. Is that the right way to do it? I mean, if you think about Brexit, to decide yes or no whether it's a good idea, you have to know about complex trade arrangements. You have to know about Ireland. You have to know about the history of Europe. And was that the right move, or shouldn't they maybe have decided, we kind of need some experts to help us out?
I mean, my answer to this is a version of what I said earlier. When you completely exclude people from politics and then you give them a chance to make a decision, yes or no, that's not really, I mean, they don't know. They don't know anything because they haven't been involved in all the, but if they had been involved all the way along, then they would have made a great decision.
Okay,
probably.
But wait a minute. So, okay, this is the thought I have, given what you just said. My thought is that just as we don't really let people do cutting-edge science unless they acquire certain tools, right? They have to go to be an undergraduate science major, then go to graduate school and get a postdoc, and then they get the fancy grant and get to be the PI, the principal investigator. There's a long apprenticeship that's involved. Okay, shouldn't there be, why not, in all domains of life, a period of apprenticeship such that through this period of apprenticeship, you earn the right to a kind of authority? So that, back to Josh's thing, authority has to be earned. It's not anything goes. It's not all voices count equally, right? Couldn't that get us back to those top-down authorities that you guys both hate? Because they paid the price. They went and they did the thing. They did the apprenticeship. And now they're reaping the benefit of that.
I think the beauty of politics is it's one thing that maybe it's exceptional, I don't know, that you get better at it just by doing it. So I think the apprenticeship is the doing of it. So I think as people are allowed to participate in their own political life, they get better and better and better at it.
Yeah, but
when you say better, do you mean better at getting power or wiser and more just?
I'm not sure either of those things. just more attuned to how it works, how to make collective decisions, how to work together with other people, all that kind of stuff. A similar point is I think we engage in horizontal forms of authority making all the time. We just don't recognize it, and we give all the credit to the vertical forms. So we don't recognize the way we are already apprentices at politics. So we're already pretty good at it. All the times we don't stab each other when we walk by each other in the street. There's no necessarily police officers making sure we don't do that. We're working it out.
Well, that's an important point, but that's something about authority, genuine authority. Look, the authority of the law. What does the rule of law mean? The law can't, if the law is just a big stick, if the law is just a stick waiting to club you, and without the stick, you might steal the thing. Then it's not really the law. It's just force, right? The law is supposed to command respect. And it commands respect because it has some kind of like authority of our will, right? So I don't know if that's pro a kind of horizontal authority or anti a kind. But there are kinds of things that command respect. And legitimate authority should command respect. Just like the well-trained doctor who cares about his or her patients. The doctor's opinion commands respect, not just because he or she forces you to. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, one thing I love to teach my students is this story by Machiavelli about Numa, the second king of Rome. he thought the Romans were totally uncivilized. So what he did is he lied and he pretended that this goddess gave him these laws. And he told people, you better follow these or you'll get killed by the gods. And he turned the Romans into civilized people. So he got the respect of the law. My question is, why do you have to do that? Why do you have to pretend and lie about an authority that you're actually creating yourself and generating yourself within your community? Like, why do you need that externality just in order to be able to trust and believe in one another?
Well, but that means if it's a true, I think you're right. If it's a pure externality, then it doesn't command respect. It commands fear, right? But if it's from us, then it commands respect. But I think we should let some, we're listening to philosophy. You're listening to philosophy talk. We're talking about authority and resistance. About, I don't know if they're a resisting or authoritative audience, maybe a little bit of both, at the Mars Theater, and we got questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
Hi, I'm Jay from Mountain View, and I'm interested in the practical issues of the fact that we seem to be losing authorities of the kind you mentioned in the introduction, the arbiters of news, trustworthiness, you know, what is, in fact, real and what isn't. And I worry about everybody having an equal participation in this for two reasons. One is laziness, and the other is confirmation bias. Do we have, in all of us, the energy to do the work to figure out what we need to know in order to make decisions or to figure out who we should trust? And are we willing to confront the fact that we all have confirmation bias and we have to fight against that in order to get to that truth?
Good question, Jay from Mountain View. And that's a question for you, James Martell, because you said, oh, the more we participate in it, the better we get. But we got to come to it with certain dispositions and not the ones he mentioned. Because if we come with a disposition of laziness, we don't like hard work, and we got confirmation bias, we're never going to, that apprenticeship isn't going to do us any good. So what about that?
I'll say two things. First, the fact that we have this horrible president and everything is exactly the problem with vertical authority. If you're lucky and you get a good leader, things are okay. If you're not lucky, you get horrible leaders, and sooner or later, you're going to have a horrible leader. So, but and then in terms of our own laziness and confirmation bias, I think that this is something that we can overcome only collectively. Like, in other words, we check each other. It's kind of a messy process, but you know, there's nothing but confirmation bias with our current leaders, right? They just talk to each other. It's just a very small camp.
I think you're optimistic. I think you're optimistic. That is, because I want to go back to Mill. Then I'll turn it over to Josh, because he wants to get on you too. We're going to continue. I think you're optimistic. Mill says, look, here's the problem. First, he talks about the despotism of custom. That's collectivity, right? And which grinding down the individual. And he says, look, most people live their lives. They don't take control of their lives. And those people only need what he calls the ape. He who lets the world or his portion of the world choose his life for him has no need of anything except the ape-like capacity for imitation, right? And that's not a really human life. And the temptation not to live a fully human life, not to own your life when you're embedded in a collectivity is really powerful. And that's what the collectivity wants of you. So I don't get why you think, oh, get us all together and what we're not going to do is enforce conformity and all this sort of stuff. I don't. I mean, Holly School was a mess, but it was trying not to enforce conformity, because it's easy to enforce conformity in a group. So why be so optimistic about groups?
Well, I think, first of all, we are in groups all the time, and they are working. Like, this is the thing that we don't give ourselves enough credit for, I guess. When we speak, when we talk to each other, when we make any kind of plan, we're always dealing with groups. And yes, it's not perfect, of course, but it's no worse than the vertical forms of authority. And the other thing I think that's really important to point out is collectively, we already know everything. The leaders are only know what they're told or what they believe or what they think.
That's your iceberg.
That's my iceberg, exactly. So the collectivity already has all the information and all the talent that it needs amongst itself. So it's a matter of getting that, figuring out how to do that.
Josh wanted to.
Yeah,
then we'll go back.
I don't want to gang up on you. And there's a part of me, obviously, that's very taken by all this. But I have the same kind of worry or similar worries about whether we're being a little too optimistic about human nature. I mean, I think, you know, I'm a literature person, so I think of the Brothers Karamazov and Ivan saying, do people really want their freedom? You know, so Nigel Farage in Britain said, don't listen to those experts. And everyone said, you are the expert. We will follow you. You know, and a similar thing happened in this country. So in other words, if we actually isn't there just something in our psychological makeup that makes us want to follow a leader? And if we take aim at expertise, isn't that just a recipe for people following bad leaders rather than people having no leaders?
Spoken like David Brooks, 2012. Oh.
Them's fighting words. Well, the first thing is, in my classes, I always teach my students to not ever talk about human nature because it's such a unknown thing and it's such a weapon. And I don't think there necessarily is such a thing as human nature. I think we respond to our environment and we create environments that work better or worse. So there are bad forms of collective action, but I think the good forms of collective action are way better than the good forms of vertical action. I guess that would be my main answer to you.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
Hi, my name is Beckett from San Mateo. I like this idea of horizontal authority that you're describing, but I'm worried that it just can't win. I see a lot of ineffective horizontal authority, like the Occupy movement, and I also believe in the sort of Darwin idea of like the strongest ideas win, and without somebody leading them, I don't know if they're going to survive. So what do you say to that? How can horizontal philosophy win?
Good.
That's a really good question. I think horizontal forms of authority can win when we stop not believing in it. In other words, like, we have all the power already. It's just that we keep giving it away. So all we have to do is not do that anymore. And you're right in the sense that every time any kind of horizontal authority has tried to express itself openly without recourse to vertical authority, it's been attacked very violently.
Right.
And that's an ongoing problem.
But it wasn't just that Occupy was attacked. It also had real problems articulating its platform. And that was precisely, you know, there was a trade-off, right? The more voices is more freedom of participation, but it's less coherency and kind of potency. And so it wasn't just the attacks from the outside. It was having a real hard time articulating what it was standing for.
You sound like you think it's an either or. But okay, I'm going to play Pollyanna.
Okay.
A both and Pollyanna, right? So a horizontal authority granting structure in which all voices get to be heard and have a take, and there's some reconciliation. So an equal vote for the office of the presidency, which we don't have here, but an equal vote for an office would be a horizontal citizen to citizen, deliberating. Deliberate as long as you like. But then take a vote and endow somebody with vertical authority. Their vertical authority, because they have certain powers to do things that others can't do. Their vertical authority rest on our a horizontal foundation. I mean, why not like that?
I think that I will repeat an earlier point that I don't think the vertical authority figure brings anything that we don't already have. So that's why I think they're just stealing that authority rather than sort of benefiting from it. I really think when we vote, we're just giving away our political power to somebody else. So if we deliberate forever and ever, that's the good part. Once we vote and then we step back, that's the bad part. Like, then we're giving up and let somebody else do it, make all the decisions.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about authority and resistance with James Martell from San Francisco State University.
When we are tyrannized by illegitimate authority, is resistance futile, as the Borg would have it, or are there effective ways of fighting back?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We'll take more questions from our very lively, authoritative, resisting sometimes audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks once again to our live musical guests, the incredible Tiffany Austin Quartet. I'm Josh Landy. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about authority and resistance. Now, we got lots of questions here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Hi, thanks. I'm Martha from Oakland. And I wanted to get your comment on a model that I'd heard about, which is the establishment of a citizen board alongside of an elected government, and the citizens are vetted, but they have a similar voice that offsets that of the elected officials. And this is in place, and unfortunately I can't remember where, but in a couple of jurisdictions, and I just thought it was an interesting model.
What do you think, James?
I'm all for that kind of stuff. I think that's just allowing people to have more of a political say in their lives and more control. The only thing I would say is that's not a replacement for the kind of widespread horizontal forms of authority that I prefer, but it's definitely better than nothing.
What about, why not have a mixed form of politics where we try to get the best of both? So you try to recruit regular citizens, so to speak, to get involved in the political process. So as you rightly points out, we can that's a way of learning about what's actually going on, what makes a difference. But we also get to recruit people who have a particular expertise. You know, maybe they've had more experience in that particular area, or maybe they're just better, you know, their mind works in that particular way. You know, someone is a great musician, somebody else has a kind of flair for politics. Why shouldn't we recruit people into those leadership positions who are really good at that, even as we participate to the extent that we can?
I still think that those kind of people, those kind of skills that they have, only are a reflection of the kind of lopsidedness of our current political structure. They just do politics more than...
It sounds like you're separating off politics. You're willing to agree that the pizza person shouldn't be your brain surgeon.
Yes.
Why is it different? You know, the brain surgeon has particular skills and particular expertise and a particular background, gone through particular training. What's the big metaphysical difference between neurosurgery and politics?
There is a difference. I think we don't all have to do brain surgery, and we don't all have to deliver pizzas, but we all have to be political subjects. So politics is something that is we all experience and it affects us. So that's a reason why we should all take charge of it. I think it is actually metaphysically different than these other fields.
Let's get some more questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talks, sir.
Hi, I'm Evan, born and raised in San Francisco. Recently, arguably the largest example of a horizontal power structure is social media and the internet.
Yes.
How's that going?
Yeah.
That's the one I hate and Josh loves, right?
So, my question is, recently we have been seeing self-stratification within the internet and people resorting to their own echo chambers. Which develops a sense of populism that would lend itself to create the kind of linear power structure that you are so against. So what is to stop people from manipulating a horizontal power structure to create their own self-empowering vertical power structure?
That's an excellent question. I just want to remind you, that goes back to our first question from Jay from Mountain View, I think it was, right? It's a similar question, given confirmation bias, information clustering, right, which
and
is
our desire for authority.
Yeah,
you don't believe it.
So I think we've got a nice book, and these are very powerful questions, and very of this moment in our international landscape.
Well, I mean, the first thing I'll say is, to sort of maybe repeat myself, is that given the fact that we have a very strong vertical authority structure right now, obviously that has not stopped this thing that you're afraid of from happening. And I would say in general that the internet and social media is kind of the booby prize for not having a political life. So people turn to that, and it is like chaotic and crazy and doesn't make any, it's not itself a political forum. So I think, I wouldn't say what happens there is what would happen if we actually were political subjects and responsible for our own lives. I'll just leave
so
it at that.
So maybe this hasn't been the right way to start the revolution, so to speak, or to resist. What would you, if you were writing a book, you know, for budding resistance fighters, you know, in various domains, right? What would be the single most, the first thing you would tell people, the one most important tool they're going to need?
I would tell them that the power of the state is absolutely nothing without our giving our power over to it. And I would just have them remember that, because the state's whole role is, it is very terrifying and it's spectacular and it does all this stuff to make sure that we don't ever think that we could live without it. And it really is nothing in and of itself. And that's my main point. Everything that the state has, it takes from us.
So I still want to broaden this out. Suppose I'm a Christian fundamentalist, not to pick on Christian fundamentalists, and I think the top-down authority of science is to be resisted, right? I think, me and Ken Taylor think, no, you are to surrender to the top-down, and I'm going to help you surrender to the top-down authority of Western science. What have I gotten wrong there? Why is the top-down authority of science not like the top-down authority of the state? You say the state has always usurped its authority. Has science usurped epistemic authority from, you know, the Christian non-believer, the shamanistic culture, the, you know? I mean, there's the science. What did Josh call it? He didn't say this, but the science technical something complex. Is that just as hegemonic as?
Definitely. I definitely think it is. I think and it may be symptomatic of the way that our political lives are kind of empty and we don't participate in it, that therefore we allow other kind of forms of expertise to dominate us similarly, because as modeled on that original domination.
So you would say to the Christian resistance, the fundamentalist resistance fighter, or whoever is resisting modernity, you would say the same thing that you would say.
Resist those climate resist change
those,
theorists.
Resist those. That sounds, see, that, I don't know. I don't think I want to follow you there. I'm more comfortable with you saying that to the state, and far less comfortable you saying that to science. And I wonder why. Can you help me understand? Am I just being crazy to see a disanalogy?
Maybe that gets back to James's point earlier about the fact that, well, we don't all have to do science, but politics is something we're all collectively responsible.
But we all have to live with the results of science. It's everywhere. Come on, it's consequences. Not just science, technology, the whole scientific, technological, bureaucratic, industrial, military complex, as you would put it. It's there. It's everywhere. It's pervasive. It's ruining the planet. It's all this. It's upending human life and every. No, it's there. It's pervasive. It's as pervasive as the state.
I think if science was sort of left in its own box, and then you could have, expertise within that based on your this and that, whatever you've done, I think collectivities could consult with scientists and see how much that aligns with their political interests and stuff. I think this current thing about climate change, it's kind of crazy to even talk about what people believe and don't believe. There's all these flat earthers now. I think all of that is a reflection of having no political life. And people turn to crazy stuff when they don't have political. I'm not saying that they would all pick things that you and I would like if they were actually politically empowered. I'm just saying it wouldn't. What we're seeing today is no indication of what that would be like.
Welcome to Philosophy Doc now.
Hi, my name is Catherine, and I'm from Berkeley. And it seems that what I'm hearing a lot about are sort of these lines drawn between things like science and economics and politics, but our ability to imagine what we could shape and how we could think and how we could be is shaped by our access to the political process, our access to knowledge. And are the lines really so clear, or it seems that they're really all the same thing?
So I think you're onto something. I have this notion of what I call transformative democracy. It's back to two of these questions. I think any kind of structure that leaves human beings as we currently are, with our confirmation bias, our laziness, our disengagement, blah, 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 is a disaster. I don't think human beings as they are. But the question is, can there be structures that transform our imagination, get us to re-see possibilities? I don't think those would be top-down. I don't think they'd be vertical. I think they'll be complicated. I don't know. What do you think, Jay?
I think, maybe you called me an optimist before, and I think I am, because I think that when people actually get a taste of engaging in politics, they love it. People think it's going to be really hard, and it's going to be really boring, and it's going to be too many nights and taken and all that kind of stuff. What's that line by Oscar Wilde? The problem with socialism is one doesn't have enough free evenings. I think once you actually cross that threshold, I've found in my own personal life that every time I get more involved in politics and actually come to those meetings, it's more exciting, and it's just something we don't get to experience enough. So I think it's just really a shame that human beings are excluded.
Well, James, you are an optimist, and that's good. And I like, in my advancing age, I get less and less optimistic, like hourly, but it's good to talk to an optimist. On that note, though, I got to thank you for joining us. It's been an authoritative conversation to which I feel no resistance.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been James Martell, professor of political science at San Francisco State University, author of The Misinterpolated Subject. So, Josh, are you feeling my authority now?
Hey, like the great philosopher Eric Cartman said two important things. Respect my authority and screw you guys, I'm getting home. So,
I think,
if you don't respect my authority, James could be right, and there's a part of me that's really optimistic. If we created radical new systems, then maybe indeed we can't even imagine what it would be like then. And maybe there would be a different kind of human nature, but given the way human beings are and have been for a very long time, I'm not sure that the attack on authority and expertise has really done us good.
I agree with him in a certain sense. If you go back to the Pleistocene, where we evolved, We have, you know, your average hunter-gatherer saw maybe 36 persons over the course of an entire lifetime. They saw them face-to-face. They deliberated about what they had very unhierarchical structures. It wasn't until agriculture and then industry that society got...
Good old days.
Yes, society got really hierarchical and more and more and more and more and more hierarchical. So we're not evolved from this. And to try and imagine our way out of these large hegemonic structures in a life-affirming way, it's so hard. But you know what? Hard things are worth doing. And this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, with apologies to Descartes, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in our community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, either here or on the radio, we'd love to hear from you. Email it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now, only one guy's got the authority to philosophize this fast. It's Ian Scholz, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholz. To get out of Poland in 1957, Jerzy Kaczynski created a fake foundation and forged letters from communist authorities to grant him passage to America. The trope of people not being who they pretend to be was a major theme in his work, most famously in Being There, about a blank person on whom people project gnomic wisdom. A controversial figure himself, authenticity-wise, Kaczynski used to tell how he commissioned a fancy uniform to look like the uniform a general might wear to a formal occasion. Supposedly, this gained him entry into all sorts of events, jumping the line at opera funding galas, getting out of speeding tickets, getting respect from dignitaries. Authority is easy to imitate, is his point. This is the essence of many confidence games and much satire. How many true crime stories involve a man who is always off on mysterious errands that he can't tell his lover about? He's with the CIA or the FBI in a top-secret mission. By the time she's learned the truth, he's really just a thief with a narcissistic personality disorder, and she's lucky he didn't kill her, all the money has been drained from her account, he's changed his name and moved on to his next victim. The con game depends not on disinformation, but lack of information. The less you know, the more convinced you are. Where do you go for weeks at a time? I can't tell you. It's top secret. It makes him seem glamorous and important, and aren't you the silly fool for doubting him? The secrecy is an aspect of his authority. There seem to be a checklist of aspects right now for authority to present. Red tie, blue suit, stern visage. Save the smiles for the grandchildren. Don't waste them on the American public. Snappy salutes, stillness, avoid big gestures. Point with thumb and fingers joined at the temps. Don't overthink authoritarian pronouncements. Don't make it a fence or an obstruction or a hedge or an impediment, even if those are what it turns out to be. It's a wall. Call it that. Confusing and maybe wrong, yes, but simple, easily grasped. The president's tweets seem to both enhance and undermine his status. They enhance it by being bold, simple proclamations distributed freely to the world. They diminish it by being tweets, ephemeral blurts blatted out at random by any damn fool with a smartphone. Also, it has become common to note that what the president tweets does not always reflect what we once called truth. This has also been seen as an enhancement of the president's power. Truth is what he makes it. It's fungible. He often points out fake news, but he seldom points to any specific lie in the media's part, but more to general widespread journalistic irresponsibility, colored by unwarranted rancor towards him. Why couldn't that be true? His administration keeps shrinking, which also enhances his authority. Less in the frame means more focus on him. The flurry of recent books about White House chaos also helps. The chaos swirls around him, the calm at the center, watching television, tweeting, golfing, somehow keeping the balls of the Republic in the air without having the least idea how to juggle. That's a leader. This has led to mixed feelings and new notions about authority is anymore. Some of the president's more imaginative followers follow a fellow called QAnon, a deep throat guy in the deep state, releasing online messages that the president is about to make his move any minute against globalist lackeys led by Hillary Clinton, somehow. The president right now does not have full authority because sinister forces are thwarting him. Strangely enough, the president himself seems to doubt his own authority, taking the word of people he saw on television over the real-life advice given by military and intelligence advisors. He's like a con man pretending to be president so he can put one over on somebody to make a score, only he really is president, which makes it hard for him to empty his wife's bank account, change his name, and head for the Bahamas. The point being, I think, that authority is a two-way street. Whether you end up as a statue in the square or having your head stuffed on a pike by the side of the road could just be an accident of history. Or wearing the right uniform at the right time to the right party. I gotta go.
Holding hands at midnight, neither dry.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Tina Pimentuan. Special thanks to Merle Kessler, Lisa Wang, Conchita Perales, Lauren Burgut, and Aaron Aguilar.
Thanks also to our musical guests, Matt Clark on piano, David Yule on bass, Sly Randolph on drums, and the one and only Tiffany Austin on vocals.
The senior producer of Philosophy Talk is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Cindy Prince-Baum. Dan Brandon is the technical director.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.